Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and author Rachel Dickinson. Dickinson's work has appeared in The Atlantic, Outside Magazine, Smithsonian, and Audubon. She is author of two narrative nonfiction books, Falconer on the Edge, which was published in 2009, and her most recent is The Notorious Reno Gang, the wild story of the West's first brotherhood of thieves, assassins, and train robbers. It was published early this year by Lions Press, and it's what we'll be discussing today. And welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tish. I'm glad to be here.
Now, the Reno book came out of a thesis for an MFA, you say. Tell us how you discovered this, because it's not a well-known family or a well-known story.
No, this is one of those obscure little stories that I think everyone who's interested in history or narrative nonfiction hopes that they stumble upon. I had to do a thesis, so I was looking around for a topic. At first, I thought I would do these lovely memoirish essays, but when I saw that everyone in my class was doing that same thing, I thought, well, I need to be different. So I turned to history, and I literally turned to history.com. And I knew that I always wanted to have this thesis turn into a book. So I thought, well, the earliest it could probably be published would be 2017. So I said, what happened 50 years ago? Went to history.com, recognized everything. And I thought, okay, what happened 100 years ago? Recognized everything. 150 years ago, they said the world's first train robbery in Seymour, Indiana. And it took me all of 5 minutes of research to realize I'd really hit on something that no one had ever heard of.
Yeah, I was so surprised. I mean, this is a huge story.
Thanks.
I mean, it is in many ways. Well, tell us about the Reno family. This is based around the Reno gang.
Well, the Reno family, this took place in Seymour, Indiana, in just pre- and post-Civil War era. And this was still kind of the Wild West in many ways. This little town of Seymour grew up very rapidly when it was laid down on the crossroads of two railroad lines. And so it went from zero houses, and 5 years later, there were probably 300 homes there. And so the Reno family had lived in this area for a long time, and they lived on the edge of the town. They actually lived in another little town called Rockford. And as soon as Seymour began growing, Rockford began losing all of its businesses. And the Renos were known as kind of a ne'er-do-well family anyway. And soon there were a series of mysterious fires in Rockford. And one by one, the buildings burnt. And as the buildings burnt, more people flooded into Seymour. And pretty soon, Rockford was nothing but kind of the charred halls of what once was a proud little town.
It became a kind of a ghost town where people snuck around.
It was totally a ghost town. Uh-huh. And old man Reno, Wilkerson Reno, and his wife, Julia Ann, began buying up all of the property, all of the land underneath these properties. So soon they owned the entire town of Rockford. And this became a really salient point when there were six kids in the Reno family. Four of them went to participate in the Civil War in various ways. But when they came back, they brought their friends from the Civil War with them, and they ended up living in these kind of burnt-out shells of houses in Rockford and kind of created their own little kind of anti-city in a way. It's a place you wouldn't want to go at night. It was filled with these thieves and gang members. It was like a syndicate crime family.
And you know, it's kind of mysterious why these boys turned so bad. I mean, they changed after the Civil War. But you described the family as, even though the parents got divorced, that they were strict. And it was kind of mysterious why these boys went so bad, you know?
The parents were strict. Now, first of all, when you're writing history, you have to look at the sources you have. The problem with when you're writing about people who may have been literate but not very literate, was that they didn't leave things behind. So we don't have letters, journals, diaries, and these are the kinds of things that you like to piece together to create kind of a full picture of someone. So when you're looking at the Reno Gang, we end up turning to the newspapers, and we turn to court records. And for many generations, the Renos showed up in these court records because they were— a lot of them were ne'er-do-wells. So,
no, that's why they were so fascinating, though, in some ways.
I know. They're fighting over property lines or brawling in taverns.
And they're doing counterfeiting. They learned how to be counterfeiters.
Yes. So when the boys—
safecrackers.
Yeah. When the boys go off to the Civil War, they meet young men like themselves. And these are people who became really hardened during that horrible war. And so when they came back home, they were kind of aimless and drifting, and they didn't know what to do. But they managed to hook up with a bunch of other people who didn't necessarily know what to do, but they managed to create their own business. They filled a niche. They began robbing people, breaking into county treasuries.
I think it's so fascinating. You know what else is so fascinating? The fact that the trains coming into small towns helped build the economy and build the community, but it also gave people opportunity to rob.
It did. And
which is fascinating to me because you talk about how there were like hundreds of different time zones when the trains first started.
Yes, until we ended up with four time zones across America in the 1880s, everyone went by local time. And that's hard for us to even imagine. Say you go to Elmira and they decide they want to be an hour earlier or maybe half an hour earlier. Anyone who was relying on the trains had to get newspapers or circulars from the place they were going or circulars from all along the way to make sure the train schedule they were looking at might jive with what actually might happen. Train travel was exceedingly popular, yet it seems so difficult to do as you look back on it. There's no one really shepherding the way. You might have to get off at one station in a town and cross town, go on a train from another station. There was no law saying that there even had to be a station, so they could just let you off on the side of the tracks.
And you could wait for days if you wanted to just stand there.
It was just kind of this crazy system, but everyone used the trains. Suddenly, people could go places. They weren't restricted to how far your horse could go in a day. It just opened up the world, and it certainly opened it up for commerce. But what was remarkable to me was that no one had thought of robbing trains before October of 1866. This just wasn't a thing. And the Reno Gang had robbed everything they could think of. They tried to stay out of Seymour as much as possible because they were living near Seymour, and this was their headquarters, and they didn't really want to sully their own lake, so to speak.
And the thing is, they got away with most of these things, too. They could bribe people, you know, with the money that they would rob, they would bribe people to get out of jail and stuff.
They always had a lot of money. So either it was money that was counterfeit money or had been laundered, you know, through one of their mechanisms by some means. But they had a lot of money, so they could always buy their way out. So no one knew how to stop them. They seemed unstoppable. So when they got kind of bored one day, they came up with this train robbing thing, and they realized, okay, we've robbed county treasuries, we've robbed these other places. Where will we find the most money in a single place? And it was in the express car of a train. People shipped their payrolls and their valuables with these express companies like American Express, Adams Express, and they would guarantee kind of point-to-point delivery. Mm-hmm.
And they did put them in safes, and they did have guards. But
They put them in safes. There was a guard. They had their own railroad car. But in a way, it made for easing pickings for someone who decided that this was a cool thing to do. So unlike the James Gang, which came later, the Reno Gang never went through passenger cars and robbed passengers. They just went straight for the big money. So they would get in there and they would demand that the express messenger open up the safes. And if they couldn't open the safes, they would just beat them about the head a bit and, you know, throw them off the train and throw the safe off the train after them. You know, they were just kind of ruthless.
I thought it was really interesting the way you say that you found out that they stopped the trains. a red lantern?
Yes.
Somebody would step out with a red lantern, like emergency. That means the train should stop, and it would be the robbers. It was so easy.
Yes, the robbers figured out, oh, we just have to act like the train people, train engineers. And because at this point, the engineers were kind of guileless. No one had done this before. So if they saw someone step on the tracks waving a red lantern, which means warning, they're going to stop the train. So it was really, in a way, absurdly easy.
And it was also inventive, too, but they'd have people waiting for them with horses and you know, outside of some of these towns. They'd go by foot.
Yep. They really, they plotted everything out, and they had a really nice system going. But that can only last for one or two robberies, and then the express companies are on to you. They're like, wait, we're losing hundreds of thousands of dollars, and so they call in the Pinkertons.
You have to talk about the Pinkertons. I think this is so fascinating. One of the first national detective agencies.
Yes. Alan Pinkerton came from Scotland in the 1840s, and he moved to the Chicago area with his wife, and he was a barrel maker by trade. But he got into the detective line, as he said, when he solved kind of a local mystery. And he just got this in his blood. He just like, this is something I want to do. And within a year or two, he ended up in Chicago as the head of their detective agency, part of the police force. And he was the first detective, really, in the United States. And then he decided, I don't want to be connected with the police. I'm setting up my own detective agency. In fact, the term private eye comes from Pinkerton's detective agency because their logo was an open eye on a sign. And underneath it, it says, the eye that never sleeps. So that's how we get private eye. So Pinkerton was just this really awesome guy who got all of these other kind of men and women around him who were really interested in solving crimes themselves. And they really prided themselves at this point in their history upon not hiring other thugs or robbers who might know the system. They actually hired honest people. And that was kind of a first, because they used to say it took a thief to catch a thief.
Yeah.
Alan Pinkerton didn't believe in that. He believed that you hire honest people and you pay them enough money so they actually want to do a good job. He had an office filled with different kinds of clothing.
That's what I was going to say. He was one of the first people to have people go undercover.
Yep, they went undercover.
Which was so clever then, right?
It was very clever. They would get onto trains, and one of their Pinkerton's first big jobs was to work with the railroads to try to see what the conductor was doing, because railroads kind of figured out they're losing a lot of money, and it was because the conductor had a lot of power. He could let his friends onto the trains. He was responsible for taking money for tickets that hadn't been purchased. He could just pocket this money. And so the Pinkerton operatives would go undercover, both men and women, and they just sit there and make notes. They were like the classic stool pigeons. And the conductors figured this out at some point and just hated them and always tried to harass them and get them off the trains. But one thing Pinkerton got his operatives to do was to make these copious notes. So the operatives were reviled, but they did a great job.
And he even worked for President Lincoln for a while, Pinkerton did, which I find really fascinating.
Yes.
That whole Civil War era is just...
It is fascinating. He foiled an assassination plot of President Lincoln as Lincoln was going to his inauguration. He hung around Washington for a while because he wanted Lincoln to make him his head of private security. And Lincoln waited a little bit too long because he got another offer from General McClellan. And so he became the private security for McClellan, and he sent his operatives out to report on troop movements of the South. And McClellan didn't last long because, for whatever reason, he was losing all these battles. Information was bad. And so Pinkerton was kind of disgraced for a while, and he ended up in New Orleans kind of on the levees counting cotton bales, trying to figure out if someone was short shrifting the federal government. And that's where he was when he heard of Lincoln's assassination. So he was so far out of the loop that he knew he had to rebuild himself. Yeah. So in 1866, when this first train robbery comes across the desk of the president of the Adams Express Company, this guy calls Pinkerton. This is Pinkerton's first big case. It's a time for him to remake his detective agency and bring them out of the dark ages of the Civil War.
I love it. I thought that was so fascinating, especially the connection with Lincoln.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know what? The strange thing, too, at the same time that Pinkerton was doing his thing, the Indiana State Legislature renewed its statute to legalize vigilantism, which I found so unbelievable.
Yeah.
That was actually legislated.
It was, because one thing that was happening in the middle part of the country, and certainly in the western part of the country at that point, was the people were settling areas quicker than they could kind of bring law and whoever was going to create order in the town. So the legislatures just passed these bills that allowed people to take the law into their own hands because they knew they didn't have the manpower to stop whatever was going on. So they gave locals the power to do this.
But the thing that really is disturbing about that is not that they would just go pick up people, but they would steal them out of the jailhouse. So, the law was running its course, and these guys would come out and lynch these guys.
Yes.
These vigilantes.
Yes. Yeah. There were a lot of vigilantes all throughout the West and the Midwest. But in the case of the Reno gang, there was a very organized vigilance committee that was organized in Jackson County, where Seymour is. And there were up to 200 people in this vigilance committee. And the most remarkable part to me was that there were never any names associated with these people. To this day, no one will say who these vigilantes were.
That's
you go
amazing.
To Seymour, Indiana, and they are mum about this whole thing. They won't even tell me the whispers of who might have been in this vigilance committee. They are keeping this 150-year-old secret very close.
God, isn't that amazing? It must have been lawmakers and good families, quote, quote. You know? I mean, they have to be hiding.
Oh, totally. And,
for a
reason. I have my own theories that I put forward in the book. But, of course, it's the people who have the most to lose. It's the guy in charge of the woolen mill, the guy who runs the textile factory, the mayor, the police chief, whatever. All those people are in cahoots because they cannot figure out how to stop this gang of thieves and robbers. And so at some point they decide to take matters into their own hands. And the newspaper editor of the Seymour papers, and there was more than one, and he was editor of as many papers as he could manage to produce at that point, he railed against the fact that Seymour was weak and couldn't seem to protect its own. And so he called for these vigilance committees very early on. And just like, these people need to be strung up. They need to put an end to this. They're harassing our town. They're ruining our town. No one will want to stop here. So he was pushing
for... He was still worried about commerce,
yes,
too, right?
Yes, pushing
money,
the Vigilance Committee on one hand and, promoting the woolen mill on the other. So he knew what his role was.
You know, I think it is funny. I mean, they did rob banks and they did get away with it, but John Reno did spend time in the penitentiary in Missouri, and Frank ended up in Canada. So some of them, I mean, they did get caught and they did serve some time, right?
Yes. The only one who really served time of the four brothers was John Reno. There was Frank, John, William, and Simeon. Frank was the oldest. And after one of the robberies, he and a couple of other guys end up in Canada. And Pinkerton pursued him into Canada and sought for extradition to bring him back to Indiana to face this railroad crime.
And that was a whole political move.
Huge.
Too, right? He had to get in touch with England. And
kerfuffle, we might say, where, yes, he had to get permission from Britain to allow these guys to be extradited from Canada to the U.S. And it caused a diplomatic flurry at one point and a problem. problem because, yes, these guys were extradited to the U.S. They get put in a jail in Indiana, and then they get lynched from the jail. And so Canada and Britain are saying, wait a minute, we allowed you to extradite these guys saying that you would keep them safe under federal control
until brought to justice.
But you failed on your end. So it caused the diplomat from Great Britain to leave the United States at one point just under protest. And the first law about really safeguarding people while being extradited was written because of this case.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rachel Dickinson. We're talking about her book, The Notorious Reno Gang. Now, I want to talk about the fact that Clinton Reno is the only one who never really got involved in the...
Clinton Reno was one of the five sons and one of the five brothers. And no, we don't really know much about Clinton Reno. We know that at one point he owned a saloon called the Hellhole.
Yeah, I love that.
In Seymour. And then, but he never went into the Civil War. He never served time. He was selling produce at that time. So there are really very few records about him. He doesn't seem to have become involved in the syndicate service, the Reno Gang service. So we don't know why.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting that he resisted.
He resisted, and some say he moved to Missouri or someplace and went insane. So who knows? Who knows?
Well, why do you think this story was never really well known, like Jesse James or Butch and Sundance and some of the most famous outlaws from the Wild West that we know about?
I think a lot of it has to do with, first of all, the time, and second of all, promotion. Jesse James, he was a horrible guy, but he was literate.
And he was handsome.
He was handsome. He wrote letters to the editors about his views on politics, and he was viewed by many people to be like a Robin Hood in some ways. He had dime novels written about him. So there was all of this literature that grew up around kind of the mysterious ways of Jesse James. And so he was romanticized. And so that's why we know about Jesse James today. And one of their most famous robberies was in Northfield, Minnesota. And that robbery was detailed minute by minute by people who were there. The Reno Gang, it's post-Civil War. The world is kind of turned upside down on its ear. We have a lot of people moving around the country, soldiers coming home. Things are in a state of flux. And the Renos start robbing trains, and like people can't believe it. No one's really recording what actually is going on.
Yeah.
They're not speaking for themselves. There's no literature that romanticizes them at all.
Well, there were so many people being slaughtered in the Civil War, too.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
the people
this story
are weary.
Got lost. It was like the Keystone Cops, right?
Yeah,
these crimes that they were committing in
a way, yeah. But at the heart of the Reno Gang is really kind of, there were some masterminds there. At the same time that the Civil War was happening, the United States was trying to regulate currency. And so they went and they created greenbacks. They created a federal currency. Up until that point, each town, each bank, sometimes insurance companies, would issue their own bills,
notes. What chaos that must have been.
It was total chaos. So people traveled with these bills, coming from local banks, and they may or may not be accepted when you're traveling outside of town. When we went to a national currency, a lot of engravers were thrown out of business. These were people who had been engraving notes for little banks or, secondary banks. And so all of a sudden you have a lot of talent out there looking for money, looking for a way to make money. These guys get sucked up into the Reno Gang. These are the ones who will take and launder the money that the Reno Gang is stealing from other
places.
And
they literally laundered it, right?
Wash the bills. Wash the bills, and these guys are really good. They create these plates, and they will just kind of reprint them with higher denominations. Very, very clever. And so millions of dollars were funneled through this gang. Yeah. It was really very sophisticated in some ways.
So very fascinating talents came out of this unknown Reno gang.
Yes, who the heck
knew? I was shocked that I didn't know anything about these people. Now, you say that you went on Google to look for some kind of obscure mm-hmm. history stories. So how did you proceed with the research after that? Did you actually go to Indiana and...
Oh, yeah. It was great. I did as much research as I could just sitting in a chair in Freeville, New York. And then at some point, you've got to go. You've got to get out of your chair and travel. So I went to Seymour. It's a 12-hour drive from Freeville. Mm. And I landed in this little town that's actually known as the birthplace of John Cougar Mellencamp. I think that's its claim to fame.
Oh, not
at
the
this
first
point.
Train robbery. Huh?
Not the first train robbery. They don't really talk much about that. But so I found myself in a little county historical society in a basement looking through Civil War records. And there were several women there. Of course, they're women doing genealogical research. Mm. And someone asked what I was doing, and I said, oh, Reno gang research. A woman sitting at a computer flipped her head around. She looked at me, kind of looked me up and down, and began to ask me these really hard questions about the Reno gang, like who was so-and-so and what did so-and-so do. And I knew I was being tested, and I had to pass this test in order to really get to the goods. And I passed her test. This woman had been the former county historian, and she smiled when I gave her my answers.
So you already had enough information so that you could answer this.
Yeah, I do my research. So I passed her test, and then she was the keys to the kingdom. She was amazing. I could just send her an email and say, wait, I don't understand how this person is related to that person and what year did this happen? And within half an hour, I had paragraphs full of information back from Charlotte.
Oh, well, this story was meant to be told, Rachel,
right? I know.
I mean, honestly.
And she knew everything, but she wasn't a writer. So we were kind of the perfect pair. She'd feed me the info, and it'd come out of my hand.
Wow.
From her mouth to my hand.
We're almost out of time, Rachel. Was there anything in the research that you found that parallels today? I mean, I did sort of in the book, but what was your take on that?
Well, just about everything parallels today. And I think anyone who is doing any kind of historical research, you can't help but think about the time period in which you live, and you're always seeing some kind of resonance. And
I know, I thought about Charlottesville and the vigilantes and the, people kind of out of control trying to take things into their own hands.
Kind of unchecked violence.
Right, and a lot of ignorance out there,
mm-hmm.
which is we're full circle right now, it seems to me.
Yeah, people say it, and it's true. You can learn a lot by studying history. And if more people would, we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel every other year.
Yeah, exactly. Real quickly, are you working on anything new?
Bunch of essays, personal essays. I don't know what's going to happen, but you'll be the first to know, Tish.
Oh, terrific. Can you give us some contact information? People want to get in touch?
Sure. You can go through racheldickinson.com, RACHELDICKINSON, and there's a way to contact me there. So, and I'd love to hear from people.
Yeah. Again, my guest has been Rachel Dickinson, and we've been talking about her fascinating new book, a piece of history that I didn't know about, The Notorious Reno Gang, The Wild Story of the West's First Brotherhood of Thieves, Assassins, and Train Robbers. Rachel Dickinson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.